On this week's show, the year in review with the crew. All right. I know it doesn't feel like it, but by the time we drop this one, it's going to be 2026, fellas. So I've assembled, you know, crew assemble. Got together my crew.
Get our aura rings together.
Get our aura, yeah, right? If you don't know what that is, you didn't listen to the holiday episode, so you need to go back and listen to the
holiday
episode.
And you don't know Captain Planet.
And you don't know Captain Planet.
Which means you're too young for Captain Planet.
Yes. So we're here to do the year in review, and I'm joined by the crew hosts, Jonathan Marsh, Travis Voss, and Nathan Wood. I'm going to switch this up, though. How would you sum up 2025 in just a few words before we dive into the episode?
Dumpster fire.
Oh, Nathan, would you want to go first? All right.
The number of people that I've had to, like, say condolences to, or like just the outside of work stuff, just like it's been a really tragic year for a lot of folks, I feel like. And so just, yeah, my heart goes out to a lot of folks that are just going through stuff. I'm ready for this year to be over.
This 2025, the year of the dumpster fire.
See ya.
I'm going to point the AI at previous episodes or previous year end reviews. This is not the first time that that has actually been said on a year in review episode. I just feel like we think it can't get worse.
Groundhog Day.
We think it can't get worse. And, you know, somebody goes, hold my beer. Watch
yeah.
out.
Ever since COVID.
I think it's the Dropkick Murphys. They have a song that says the worst day since yesterday.
I love that. The worst day since yesterday. That's awesome. I gave the other two a little bit of time to think about it. Travis, how would you sum it up?
The three things that keep coming to mind are AI, mega projects, and uncertainty. Those are the topics that seem to keep coming up for me.
I can't disagree. I cannot disagree. So we have the dumpster fire.
Well, that's just like a blanket term for everything.
I think we all agree with that. So we're just not going to say it the second time. But everyone's right. Like, yeah, pretty much. Dumpster
it's
fire.
It's my job to say the quiet parts out loud.
I want to throw my pencil over. I go, well, they took mine. All right, what are we going to do now? Jonathan Marsh, what about you?
I get where Travis is coming from, but I think this was the year that, you know, AI strangled out the rest of tech. Because, like, this was, when you look at, like, the new tech that doesn't have AI, it's like, I don't want to, they did some things, but there just wasn't a lot done. So this was the year that AI kind of strangled all of that. And for me, it was kind of a year where I was constantly like, yeah, we can build that. We don't need AI. Nope, we can build that. Yep, we don't need AI. Like, and I feel like it kind of dominated. And then, you know, like Travis said, I think the other thing that dominated for me was this is the year of the data center. You know, I mean, the amount of money, effort, construction focus that is on data center builds. Like, I mean, it used to be, there was like it'd mix out over chip manufacturers and, you know, we have some cogen plants, and now those same conversations are just data centers. Can you get more data centers? Can you build more parts? Do you have more switch gear for data centers? Like, it seems to be, again, like overwhelmingly AI in data centers this year, at least from my sort of unique perspective, I guess. How about you, Jeff? Where do you call this one in? You've been listening, but
I've been listening, and I was thinking about it, and I'm going to go to a term that Nathan and I use quite a bit. And I think it was the year of inflated expectations. I think it may have landed.
Can we call it Mount Stupid? The year of Mount Stupid.
The year of Mount Stupid. Because I think you're right, man. I think there was just so much inflated hype and expectation around what's happening. And I'm not going to hold that to just the construction industry. I think as a whole, there was this big, beautiful, whatever it might be, and it's just not materializing. And we're not living in reality of can we be grounded for a second and realize, like, the world goes in cycles. There's hype around everything. And then there's a reality of where it delivers. Let's just let it deliver.
I mean, again, on that path of peak of inflated expectations to trough of disillusionment, that there are more folks that are in that trough of, they have tested, they have heard the hype, and they know it's not reality. I think it goes back to what Jonathan was saying. Like, I think that is a little bit of that sentiment, maybe that frustration or depression or whatever, like, oh crap, it isn't going to solve everything that we're entering, because the hype was so high, right? Like, the higher the hype peak is, then the harder we're going to fall. So, you know, shame on us for hyping it up.
Well, and I'm with you, man. Like, I'm unprecedented job losses this year in major markets and major areas, and you just got a lot going on that I'm with you. So I'm just hoping that the peak of Mount Stupid with a whole bunch of people hanging on to keep us up there. So let's move on from it. We're going to get into the year in review and talk to everybody about what we're thinking. But remember, if you want to follow us and learn what's going on, check us out on youtube.com/@thecontechcrew and follow us on social media. Make sure you follow each of the hosts. Make sure you follow the show. That's where you're going to learn the most, and stay tuned for some new things in 2026. Are you trying to reach the innovators and decision makers in construction technology? Then look no further than sponsoring the Contech Crew. That's right, we're taking new advertisers. Email us at advertising@thecontechcrew.com to learn more. All right, so I'm going to kick us off. We're going to talk about a few topics, and we kind of talked about this ahead of time, and we're just going to kind of roll through them. But for me, I have to thank our good friend Sean McGuire for my first one of the year, because I am going to start on a positive, that I think it is the era of the data-empowered contractor. Where we was getting ready to do the keynote at MEP Innovations, and Sean said, I don't like any of those words. I think that we're going to take this to data-empowered. And that went everywhere with me. You know, Travis, we were at Smackna National this year, and thanks for recording it, by the way, because I got to look back at how packed that room was. It wasn't just how I felt. It was a packed room, and, you know, it was Joseph Lanzel and Robert Atwell and Kevin Gill Jr. that joined me, and really everybody leaned in. I mean, it was standing room only, and, you know, that was the end of the year. So in that middle there, you know, we really focused on those that are, I think, really getting stuff done are focusing on data, data, data. You know, so for me, that was, you know, that's a big one on, you know, what does it mean to bridge that gap, right? We gather data, and we've been gathering it forever, but why? What can you do with it? So, you know, that's mine.
I thought a great example of that, just doubling down on that, Bill Stranahan with Superior Group was super transparent with kind of what they were doing on like a large, you know, data center project to track really, really granular, like change management and things like that, that you would totally think is like a kind of, hey, this is my IP, or this is my kind of like behind the hood. So it's like one, an example of a very much that data enabled contractor, but also like, hey, here's where we are. I'm comfortable sharing this with my peers, knowing kind of like, you know, good luck keeping up. And the story was more around what was the situation with the project and the owner that led to that level of data, you know, that we all wish we could be at. And it gets back to this conversation of the motives of like, why should we do it in the first place? And I think that is where the conversation has led to, you know, in a good way. That is a positive note, is that it's less about the hype and more about the use case and the like, why do we want to do it? And do I have the data today to do this automation or this use case that I want to do? And so we're helping folks, I think, get away from the hype and more to like, you know, how do I speak in prompts? How do I, you know, validate if I have the right data or not? You know, there is a language that we have to learn how to speak that I still can't quite do yet, but hopefully helping to spread the right words around.
One of the places that I think the hype is starting to pay off, I did a presentation several years ago now at talking about data analytics, and people were asking what to collect. And I'm like, collect everything, because you just don't know yet. You don't know what you're going to need. You don't know what you're going to want. And there's a conversation in there about, you know, clean data, data cleanliness, and all
everything
that.
Everything with an asterisk, right? Everything that's easy, right, and reliable, right, or something.
But there are useful ways now with AI to clean some of that up, to normalize some of that, and then to do some of that analysis. And I think that that's where some of the potential is going to pay off. To your point, Nathan, like, just, and Jeff as well, like, that's where the contractors are starting to win is, yeah, you've gone through your digital transformation and you've generated all this stuff. Now what, right? And I think that's where we're seeing some of those tools starting to pay off.
I would agree with you. Jonathan, what are your thoughts on the data this year?
I very much agree. And I think that there's there's a level at which I'm really happy to see a lot more contractors taking on data scientists as interns and taking on data scientists within their organization. Because like, I feel like we're at the beginning of understanding how to use data. There's sort of like, I don't want to say big rules to data that the people that are in data science sort of understand better than the rest of us. But I feel like we haven't built out the rules of thumb about how you should use data in construction, and having data scientists come into all of those construction companies is going to do that. Like, it's going to give us familiarity with the way that data scientists talk about it. It's going to give us some of that feedback. I know we talked about on the last one, and I always mention like kind and wicked environments. And, you know, like a kind environment is where the data is going to come back. It's going to repeat. It's going to be clean. It's going to be usable. In a wicked environment, you may only see that data point once, and it really doesn't predict anything. And I think some of those basic heuristics, like those basic rules of thumb, getting contractors that have a data scientist on staff or know them, or at least, like you said, are interested in going listening to people speak about it, I think that really raises the entire industry really fast. I would say everybody that I've met that has a data scientist on staff talks about data differently than the people that don't. You know, the people that don't, and it's nothing to take away, but I really do see that as like a fundamental difference when I'm talking to mostly technology people, but technology people in construction.
Shout out to Sasha Reed, I think, first came up with that term digital literacy of like, you know, can you speak just the grammar of what is the difference between a standard and how you normalize your standard against someone else's standard and all these terms that we kind of blend together. And I never know if I'm using them right or not, but yeah, you know, like half of it is just, yeah, like can both sides of the conversation understand that? And just because we were talking about normalizing earlier, I think so much this is, yeah, we need the data to be normalized, but normalized for who or for whom? I don't know, not a grammar person, but like, again, like who are we normalizing it for is the big question that gets, again, back to the use case, back to the why and everything you were saying earlier, Mark. So just doubling down on
that. Yeah, I agree. And there was, you know, language is important, and it's been interesting for me being the person out there talking about it because, you know, Travis, to your point, it was all about collect data. When we started, this is all about collect data. And the cool part has been this shift. And I have to give another shout to Joseph, because it was really him who I heard it from multiple times was, okay, we've been collecting the data, but how do we use the data? Like, how do we use this to drive our businesses? And he's at this point where, and he and Kevin Gill are as well, where they're, you know, really digging into, they're using it to find areas for improvement, to find areas that they of risk that they can mitigate and get ahead of, et cetera, like where their businesses and which jobs are having trouble, et cetera. So they're moving to using it. And that's really cool. And especially because that, I think that actually made more people in the room who were still in that collection phase go, oh, that's why I'm doing this. Like, it seems elementary that's what you're going to do. But I think sometimes you get so focused on, you know, you get that tunnel vision, collect, collect, collect. It's like, well, how are we going to use it? And we are seeing that shift. And I'm going to roll one thing back that I used to say, and it's going to go back to trying to get us all off the peak of Mount Stupid or the inflated expectations. We used to say, how many times did we say this? And all three of you have heard me say it plenty of times, so I'll take just as much of a mea culpa, but you're going to be a technology company that dabbles in construction, right? We've said that a lot. I want to roll that one back. That's just like the construction technologist. Truth and transparency, it was invented on this show, and I've been doing everything I can to get rid of it since, because it is a glass ceiling. It was a tool to get people to understand that technology was a part of construction. We have to go back to using technology to be better construction companies that use data intentionally, that use technology intentionally. You're not a technology company. Your job is not to be the best at technology, because nobody gets paid for that unless you're building software to give to other people. Your job is to be the best at whatever trade, whatever part. If you're a CM, if you're a GC, you know, you get paid for putting work in and delivering projects. So I'm going to take a mea culpa there, and I want you all to be data empowered and not technology companies. So one of my own there that I had to go on.
For the record, I never said that you're a technology company, but you know.
I agree.
I would add that this is one of the areas where I can be really positive about AI, because people have been collecting data forever, and AI is not anything. It's a way to look at your data. Like I was joking, it's the microwave and your data is the ingredients. And I think people finally have an easy way to get at this data that they have an easy way to explore and be curious about data. I don't want you to use AI to change your company instantly. What I would love you to do is go be curious about the data you have, and be curious with one of these large language models or one of the other models that are out there, because there was a long time where we couldn't, you know, like you had all the data, but you needed a data analyst to even be curious about what you could get. Now, at least you can figure out kind of directionally, like which way do I want to go? Does this data seem to make it easier to make a decision? Can I really predict what my business is going to do in the future from the data I have today? And I feel like that play that AI is encouraging in everybody helps drive that. My data is valuable, because the more we get actual value out of it, we're getting paid on the decisions we're making about that data. Now it's valuable. You know, everybody else in marketing knew it was valuable, but we didn't. Now we're starting to realize that. And I think that's one of the positives of AI. I'm like negative all the time. So give AI a point for curiosity and play on data.
One, I would say, yeah, AI is really good right now at creating correlations in data. Again, whether or not those correlations are meaningful or have any actions, like that's where the human comes in, right? But just, you know, finding those needles in the haystack, it's much better at, where we used to take a long time. And that's why, yeah, we would collect data and just let it sit there and rot, or dark data, or whatever you want to call it. But, you know, yeah, AI can really help us accelerate from just collecting it into modeling it, and then getting insights from the modeling of it that then lead to some sort of course correction or other metric or whatnot from it. So again, back to just digital literacy.
And so I think we've hit this one up, and I want to take us into our next one, because I think this is for, you know, John and Travis especially. This is a big one. I think we can say, I'm gonna go out on a limb here. This is a limb. And I'm going to say that prefab modular has hit the escape velocity. It is no longer like, should we do it? Could we do it? Damn it, we're not going to do it. It is, not only do we need to do it, but we need to do it at scale, and we need to shift this industry now.
As the outsider, I would say mechanical, yes, and not still sure about electrical and sheet metal, but where you got, yeah, as those representatives, Jonathan, Travis.
I would put sheet metal in the same place as mechanical. It is the electric that's lagging behind, but they're starting to catch up. And what you're seeing, and maybe this is something that we'll touch on a little bit later, is you're starting to see some of that contraction in the marketplace or M&As and stuff going on. So you're starting to get these companies that are starting to have all three trades or multiple trades and catching each other up that way. But yeah, to your point, Jeff, too, what I'm seeing is, you know, I hit it on when I talked about the magic mega projects, is just not, there's not enough of those types of contractors to go around and do all of those types of work. So you're seeing the small and medium sized shops becoming fabrication facilities to feed those, or vice versa, right? You can go the other way too, where they're the large national mechanical contractor, sheet metal contractor, electrical contractor, maybe are hiring the labor of the install. But either way, we all know multiple of these types of contractors that are now shipping components all over the country, right? It's they're building large structures that fit on rail cars. I've seen some of that.
Is there a term for that, real quick, like scope shifting, or like, because I like what you're saying there, Travis. Where like we're seeing contractors either giving up parts of work or taking on more work as we figure out prefab. Like, yeah, we don't really have a term for that activity.
We kind of just refer to it as partnering, because you know, you do have those pockets in. I think it's pretty obvious in some of those areas where these projects are going in. They're going in because cheap land, cheap energy, and water, and some other resources, right? So they're going into areas that aren't typical for large type construction. So you have these large national contractors that move in there, and they don't have the local presence. So then they do start to look for local partners to, you know, supplement whatever they're doing in that area.
Yeah. And contractually it is, it'd either be a joint venture or like just a really large, yeah, subcontract.
Yeah. Or sub of a sub of a sub.
Yeah. I mean, you can go, I did a webinar this year with Josh Bone, and you know, we talked about that, and the electrical space itself too, is that one of their problems is they were buying out every scope. Right. And you can't do that. Right. And you can't get good at anything by doing that. And there is this shift that I think is going to make electrical much more available for fabrication in many more areas, because they're going to focus on, and I'll call it scope shift with you, Nathan. I think it's a fairly good term to use. But the idea is, look, you go in and now you pick the, you know, of the 10 scopes you would normally do, you know, you do five of them really, really well, and you know, you can fab them and you know what you can do. Well, take the other five and find people that can, you know, sub with you, JV with you. That's their specialty, right? And I think we're seeing that consistently, especially given, I mean, gosh, look at the growth in the electrical market. Everything's electrified, right? I'm just doing some looking at, you know, just the amount of each trade and what they're doing. And the electrical is growing at an unbelievable rate because of that need. But also, I mean, I think you're right. I mean, one of the quotes that I grabbed for this was, you know, big major contractor, trade contractor said, labor isn't coming back. Prefab is how we scale without people. The labor's not coming back. Although, gosh, he's getting a lot. I mean, I might have to start paying the guy, Travis, but Joseph Lanzel is going to get another one, because it was him who said, much like the future is here, but it's not evenly distributed. His whole thing is, listen, there is labor, but it is just not equally distributed. And prefabrication is a way to do that. Look, we're seeing drops in certain areas of the country on the amount of work, given the data centers. You know, you said it, Travis, like the hyperscalers, the data centers, the EV battery, advanced manufacturing, they're all going into areas where, you know, classically there isn't those contractors held in. And that's drying up work in other areas. Well, you know, we heard it at MCAA, like they're looking to pay railroad, you know, to extend it closer to your prefab facility so you can do that. And I mean, we got a hand that he was on the show. So Britton Langdon started a new company called buildfactory.io. If you haven't checked it out, check it out. He wants to be the service to connect fabrication needs to fabricators. And I mean, I think that's a huge opportunity to also equal out work, right? And I just, you know, and I will say, I will argue with you, Nathan, there. And I think, and Travis can say, it may be that the sheet metal isn't as technologically advanced in their fabrication, but they have been fabricating for way longer than most, and fabricate most, right? Because it's the biggest. So I think that's a distinct difference there.
They're the only trade that build what they install.
Yeah. Yeah.
From raw material.
And that's kind of what's happening. Like, we're at a point of convergence for like a lot of stuff that makes prefab work. We have these data centers going in all over the place that allow us to build basically contractor driven commodities. We can have a room that's going to show up in 100 different places. And that wasn't always the case, you know? And you look, it's like we had a convergence around erasing geography around the time of COVID. And then you have the data centers coming out and saying, it's almost like they decided to build new hospitals all the same way, all over the United States all at once. And now contractors can say, well, I can build commodities for that. Like I can build, you know, I can build these cells and I can keep building the same thing. So like the opportunity was just insane there. And then add on, you know, the money and the desire to do it. It really is. It's a great time to be in prefab. I struggle with the labor part a lot. I go to a lot of fab shops and a lot of people are very much looking, they're not looking as much at training the people as maybe they should be. Okay. Like when manufacturing kicked off during the Industrial Revolution, one of the biggest mistakes they made is they really didn't train people as much as they should. So you end up with 100 people in a really fractionalized, like broken up, disjointed workflow, because not everybody knows how to do everything. And they're like, oh, but it's simple. You just pull a lever. And like, historically, that doesn't ever work. Like you need, you get them in the door and they're making money for you pulling the lever, and then you start training them so that we have this workforce we're looking for.
Before you leave that, I think that is a call to action for 2026 for sure, is trades better understanding the other trades that they interface with. I know Travis knows this. We've been learning a lot about this, the research of like, whether it's the drywall or structural steel or concrete or any of these guys that, again, we can complain about them all day long, but if we don't talk to them about, you know, how they're doing their work, how we're doing our work, and where those things interface, like all these things are communication breakdowns where we have all the reasons, you know, that we can complain that we're wrong, because typically MEP comes in later than all of those trades, unless we're lucky. But yeah, I think there's so much to learning from other trades and fostering those conversations that I think we're going to continue to see more of that'll help solve these shared pains, I think.
Well, I think you're correct, right? Because I think the other thing John's talking about is you have people in those shops that don't know what the other side of the shop is doing. And
even that level,
We go more and more automated, you know, we talked about this a lot, that we are going to be fabricating and pushing to the machinery itself. The humans are going to need to understand not that they're pulling the lever. They're going to need to understand what role they play from beginning to end of this flow to create a finished product in order to be able to continue to adapt and grow. And by the way, offer innovation as needed, because that's who's going to see it, right? That's the other thing is if you only see the lever, you don't know. You just pull the lever. You don't know why. It's why am I pulling the lever? Where is it going? Where did it come from? And what are we all trying to do? And that's when somebody's going to say, well, hey, if you give me two levers, then I can keep up with the people ahead of me and I can feed the people behind me, you know, after me more, and we're going to get more of a flow. That's very simple, but there is that opportunity for innovation, for change. You know, that's, you're right.
I think they were looking at, like, at the first, when the fab shop started, they were looking at the mechanical side of lean. And now I think they got to look at that pillar that says engaging your workforce is like, that's really one of the base pillars of lean. I would call it like lean consulting, but of having a lean fab shop is you have an engaged workforce that understands what's next, what's before, understands where the stops are, understands that they need to do something if there's a backup, you know? And I think that's huge. I'm going to get yelled at if I don't mention something about the electricals, because I'm working with like a number of electrical shops right now on prefab, like not an insignificant number. So I feel like the trades, I actually feel like you were right. Like, mechanical's doing the best right now at fabrication with the sheet metal right on the end. And I would have thought the sheet metal was doing more, but when you look at it, they were so well established in what they built that they didn't look outside their boxes quickly. And then the electrical side, I'm just flat out telling you, it was a barrier to entry problem. You go into their shops and they're like, I'm like, well, do you have any welders? And they're like, no, we don't weld metal. And I'm like, well, you know, it's really hard to make a module if you have nobody weld. And, you know, you go to a mechanical shop, we had welders, we had cutters, we had metal workers, we had like the working craftsmen, the tradesmen that you see in a mechanical shop, in a sheet metal shop, lower barrier to entry to start fabrication. On the electrical side, when you're there and you're talking to them, you're like, okay, this is just a barrier to entry problem. You guys are trying to outsource stuff you need to insource, and you have some areas that you need to learn, because again, a lot of it is simple. Like, hey, if you don't have metal trades people that can weld, it's going to be a lot harder for you to think up making a module than if it's Bob and he's sitting next to you every day. Now I know I got Bob. Oh, module seems easy. I can experiment. Electrical didn't do that. I feel like they're getting there very, 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 very fast.
They have
but
to.
I bet you they look more like manufacturers at the end of the day than the other side, because they're coming at it with a different mentality.
Well, and what you're explaining is the fundamentals of the theory of constraints, that whole tell me how I measure and I'll tell you how I behave concept. Because yeah, like let's just say that welder is the, you know, like you can't finish the product without the welder. So, you know, if your welder isn't showing up on that day, why would you have other people getting more work done that's just going to stockpile a bunch more work if everything's waiting on that one welder? And it's like, those are the things that like we've been in this mentality of like producing. It's like, well, no, throughput is about how many things done did you get from how many things started. So you don't want a large work in progress, a large WIP in the middle. You want to reduce that WIP. So yeah, there are fundamental, again, measurements of what was a productive fab shop that we have to actually beat out. It's like, you know, teach yourself to not smoke, or I don't know, whatever things. It's like, yeah, like just because we know why to do it, you got to change that habit. It's really hard to change your habits.
Yeah, Jeff was there at SMACNA, and the first thing I said when I started talking to the people at SMACNA about their shops is I said, tell me what's the most important thing in shop productivity. And they say this and that. I said, it's when I get paid. Your shop is not productive until I get paid. So if you're a contractor who doesn't get paid until it's in the air, you got a bunch of stuff sitting outside your shop, build new delivery to the job site. All right. Because it's obvious where the problem is. The problem is wherever that backup of work is. And if you don't get paid until it's in the air, then, I mean, think about your fab shop as including the field, I guess. And it, like you said, it's that it's not productive if it's just sitting there in a big pile and I don't get paid for it. It's cool that you build it, but it doesn't work.
It's fab to field the financials, right? That's the thing. Like, none of it matters until it's installed and we can charge for it and we can get paid, right? We're in the business to make money, and too many people misunderstand that process. Like you said, Nathan, I mean, even if I have all my kits created and ready, I don't get paid for those sitting inside. If I don't have the field team mobilized and ready and sequenced and ready to go, I'm not going to get paid for that. And, you know, I do think this opens up some other opportunities, which I think maybe we'll do a 2026 future cast. Yeah, I'm already saying we're going to do that because we're going to run out of time here and I don't have time.
Yeah, because there's a whole general contractor's perspective on this that we're not thinking about of like, yeah, once it leaves your fab shop, now there's the whole, well, a GC doesn't want all of your widgets on the job site at one time. We don't have the laydown space for it and X, Y, and Z. And so, yeah, this whole respect for perspective.
Tact and flow and, you know, just-in-time delivery, et cetera.
Line of balance, yeah.
But I also think there's other forces coming. I've had two recent conversations that really opened my mind that I'm really not ready. I'll be honest, and it's rare for me. I'm not ready to have the discussion on camera yet because I haven't fully thought it through. What I will say, though, is it lies around this one. We have been building data centers for a while now. We are no longer building data centers. We are building, because that is bringing the data to the processing. We are now building AI farms. They are completely different. We are building something wholly different than we were before. The hyperscaler is something that we never thought about. I'm not ready for it yet. Honestly, I just had two big conversations about, you know, if you think about it in racks and data centers now, everything is what it used to be on site, but it's, you know, at a massive scale. They're not going to have, that's not what they're trying to build anymore. They're trying to build massive AI, you know, tons of chips it's an AI processing facility. It's very different. It's very different in its consumption of power. It's very different in its architecture. It's asking very different things. And this shift is something, like I said, I'm not completely ready. If you're listening out there and you want to talk to me and teach me about it, I'm willing to listen. Let's talk about it. But that's coming. What? That'll be in a 2026 episode. I swear I'll get there. And, you know, Marsh, I can already see you kind of churning. And Nathan, I can see you churning. So we'll get there. But we can't get through this year without two more things. And, you know, we got to say goodbye to Travis. Travis had to leave us. Sometimes things happen. That's life. He says, see you later. We'll see him in 2026 for sure. The consolidation. Let's talk about, this was the year of M&A. We had Miller Electric bought up by EMCOR. We had, I've just got to get my list here because I can't. They're so crazy. I can't remember them. They did Danforth too in that. You had Quanta that bought DSI. Mm-hmm. You actually had Quanta bought
Cupertino.
Cupertino as well. They bought Cupertino first and then they went ahead and bought DSI as well. And then we saw, didn't we see Andy J. Egan is bought by a PE company as well? I'm not sure who purchased them yet, but they have been acquired. And the underlying tone everywhere we've been is you can kind of smell the merger, the acquisition cooking in certain places. And we saw that a lot in technology too, right? I mean, I'm looking back to see who some of these major acquisitions were this year. But, you know, there was, truth and transparency, Bluebeam acquired GoCanvas this year. We acquired Firmus this year. So you're seeing a lot of mergers and acquisitions. I mean, Jonathan, I know this has been a big trend we've been talking a lot about.
Yeah. And I think we always end up with sort of two buckets. We end up with people that have skin in the game and understand the industry and people that are looking for short-term investment opportunity. And it always seems like the people that are looking to consolidate for the industry, they have a plan. There's some real skin in the game for them to make sure that they do a good job and make sure that they're building a future for whatever businesses they buy. Like they're training new people and everything else. And the short-term investment, which tends to be some of the PE, not so much, not all of the PE, by the way, because I definitely have, I have PE money that is funding major positive changes for contractors that are not on a 3-year time schedule. But those 3 and 5 year time schedules, those are usually not awesome things for a market. And while I'm bullish on a lot of the, and I think that some of the big mergers, especially some of the ultra big contractor mergers, are necessary and help the industry. I worry about the small short-term investment idea with something that has as much risk as us, and definitely with something that requires just the skills trades. There's a reason that they're called skilled trades, and it takes a long time to get them that skill. I think on the other show we said, like, getting a good VDC person in that seat, and like a good one, is like a 7-year timeline. So if you buy a company that's you're only going to own for 3 years, what's your incentive to really keep up those training that's going to cost you? That's my worry. On the plus side, with some of the supply chain issues that we're having, with some of the more manufacturing that we're doing, with some of the commodities that are required for what we need to build, these mergers may be the only reason that we're able to build enough to sort of meet the demand for new buildings and to meet the demand of the actual building market. You almost need something that can cure some of those supply chain issues.
Yeah, I'm with you. Nathan, thoughts on the mergers and the acquisitions market?
I definitely remember us having this conversation, I think about a year ago. Yes, I agree with everything that Jonathan said. There are probably some that are playing the short game. And if they are, they're probably buying somebody that is pretty well established and probably has pretty good processes in place. Like I'm guessing my optimistic hope is that there is a net positive of better data, better processes, better standard operating procedures through the consolidation that there's, and even like from a buying power standpoint, like I feel like I hear so many from the trade contractors complaints that, oh, well, we can't argue this to the GC or we can't do this because of kind of the position that we're in. But those, you get into larger organizations and you start hearing more of these creative strategies of how folks are making better margins because they're in better positions to negotiate because they're just frankly bigger. Although there are concerns and risks we should be looking out for, my hope is that it's a net positive.
So, I'm with you there. I agree, Jonathan. There's a lot of that PE money that's short-term related, and I think they're going to find real fast that this industry doesn't do well for that. I mean, they've been doing it in others, and those others are pretty good for it, but I don't believe we are. However, I do, and I would double down on, you know, like I'll use the MCOR of Miller and Danforth. Each of Miller and Danforth have incredible IP inside of their organizations and how to that now the rest of MCOR has access to, right? And then and can spread that wealth across their organization and bring new skills. And, you know, we know that Quanta, you know, bought into Cupertino, I think on the outside, really to get into new markets, but also for that same exact thing. So I think in the end, it's kind of needed. And I think you're right too, Nathan. Like, I'd be surprised if they don't buy up, if we don't see some more of this consolidation. And it does change the conversation. It takes a little fear away in some respects, right? Because, you know, you might have to move your workforces to other places, but there's not like there's a lack of work in a lot of those areas for those companies. So they can stand their ground and not just do things the old way. They can do things, you know, they can make changes. They can say, hey, listen, you know, John, to your point, you know, you can say, listen, I'm not going to have 250 SKUs for you. I've got 5. And this is how we do it. And by the way, we do it fast. We do it well. And we reduce risk and we do it on time. And it works for your systems. So here you go. I mean, I think that's a big one for us on the software side of things. I honestly think this, I'm going to use this as my own little segue into, we predicted this. If you look back to the year ahead in 2026 or 2025, we said this was the year because we already saw it in at the beginning of 2025. We said, this is what you're going to see this year is we had seen it in SaaS already, a constriction. It was time for things to constrict. Right. It's the no more shiny, you know, we're not growing out. We're actually looking at our systems and getting more minimalistic, starting to realize what our core systems are, that we can do more with what we have. To your term, Nathan, that I got some credit for recently, we can move from integration to interoperability to really make these less tools work together better. And I think you saw that, right? I mean, I think that's causing an interesting software market for us right now.
Yeah, and I think that's primarily customer driven, just the understanding of the customer to know what they're asking for, and not just I need APIs, but no, I need an API to do X, Y, and Z. And the number of folks are saying, hey, I need my Procore to talk to my ACC. Hey, I need my Trimble to talk to my Kahoot. I need my Newformer to talk to my whatever. Again, how we do that becomes a lot more complicated because it depends on whose system is sharing to whose system. But at least I think we've got everybody coming to the table saying we recognize this is a larger interoperability breakdown. There's a lot of waste and a lot of duplicate entry created because we're not solving this. But also industry knows that it's not as easy of a solution as we maybe first thought it was going to be.
Yeah. John, I'm wondering.
Okay, so over this last year, I have never been shown more clearly that we have the solution and refuse to give it to you than this year. That was this year's theme. We have the solution. We refuse to give it to you for a marketing reason. And that's been my trouble with the Banger software is we're now looking at, well, we need to make sure that we get your money next year for your license. So we're going to take three major things that would make everything better and put them over here. I feel like with the mergers, the marketing gets to the point where it's predatory. And I think part of the pullback from the contractors, part of the pullback from the contractors is just you guys are ripping us off, constantly making up reasons that we can't do something that should be very easy. I was doing shop layout of equipment and couldn't get drawings of the equipment until the person purchased the equipment. And I was like, wow, you know what a pig in a poke is? It's when you used to have to buy a baby pig inside a bag, but you weren't allowed to look in the bag. I mean, this is like, and again and again, though, I run into the same thing is you don't have a functional capabilities problem. If you had your developers can easily solve this problem, it ends up being a political or a marketing problem. And I'm not calling out any large people in particular, but I'm going to say all of the large ones, I have run into direct problems where it's not a problem of capability. Your industry is not going to get this solution because it's not good for our marketing. And I have a tough time weighing that against their need to remain in business because there's definitely a need for them to make enough money to remain in business. But when I look at the consolidation, I actually think negative. Most of the time I think negative because it injects a more aggressive, more predatory marketing stance into a company that might have been a startup. Startups tend to not be very predatory about their marketing. That said, we're not having enough startups survive. So maybe they need to be more predatory. But like for me, my personal standpoint is I like having the separate software. I think that we're pulling back because too much attempt to sort of game this system. And it's becoming too transparent when you're gaming us. So and I think that's something for software to be really, really careful about.
I will say, yeah, if industry's progressed in the last year, I would say that software has regressed in the last year.
I think I sit there.
For sure. Yeah. As much as industry's moved forward, I think industry's moved backwards. I'm sorry, software's moved backwards.
Well, and I've you know, I'm on the record a lot of times saying this, and I will continue to say it. Once the big players figure out, just like how many times have I done this? This phone is an Apple phone. Yes, I use an iPhone. But I run Microsoft on it. I run Google on it. I connect to Amazon with it. They all figured out, by the way, how many of you have a Microsoft phone out there? None of you. How many of you remember that they were trying to make phones? They also tried to make a freaking iPod or whatever the hell that, the Zune, and it does not exist because they realized that, and how many of you are listening to this on a Mac? And are running Microsoft Office on that Mac as well, they realize that all of that interoperability creates a rising tide and drives usage. And John, to your point, you don't feel like you're being held out on. You don't feel like, you know, you're being squeezed. You're really, truly using the tools that you need. Now, I would disagree. I think we are starting to get to the point, especially when talking to contractors that are realizing they've progressed enough that they want less tools that do more, that are more integrated, that are more part of what they do. There are those tangents and those areas where new apps are coming out, new things are coming out to solve new problems, but there's less of an appetite for that. It's more like, I don't want an app for that. I want to know that my app can do that. And that leads to your point of like, well, I don't want to make my app do that till next year when you got to buy your license again. So, I mean, it's not easy, but I do think that like at some point, somebody's got to put the swords down and realize, what did we say? Let's bring back co-opetition. It needs to come back. We just talked about this on the Dorks. We're going to talk about it and finish it here. Coopetition needs to come back. AI is here to stay. It's not going anywhere, guys, but you know, it's not your strategy. Please, please stop asking what our AI strategy is and go back to asking the questions in 2026 of what are my biggest problems and what do I need to solve? And by the way, what are my biggest customers? What are my customers' biggest problems? Because honestly, if I've learned anything this year from all the things, those that focus on solving their customers' problems are the ones that end up being the most profitable in the end in ways they never saw coming, right?
Well, and in our industry, who is your customer can be a very kind of ambiguous term, right? You know, depending on your role, the customer is just whoever you are interacting with that receives, you know, information from you or services or whatever, right? So it could be someone inside your company. It could be someone outside your company. Yeah, customer is a very vague term. So yeah, don't think it has to be someone that gives you money.
That is very, very true. It's not necessarily somebody who gives you money. Jonathan, final thoughts.
On the year or on software?
On the year. We're going to leave that software one right where we left it.
I'll give you the software one, too. The software.
All right,
one
go
is,
for the software one. And then
we have to. Come on, man. Is that we they need to, like, there is this law called Wheaton's Law, and you just need to write that into your contract. Just at the bottom, say, I just want you to follow Wheaton's Law, and everything will go away and be fine. But for the year, I actually am pretty excited going into next year. There is a lot of movement. There is some real, like a cool little problem in the data centers and everything else. That is a fun puzzle to solve. Like how fast can you build them? How well can you build them? And I like that. It's like, I don't want to say it's going to the moon, but there's some level at which like you want a big challenge. And we have a big challenge for next year. AI, while I want to crucify it this year, I feel like everybody's, you know, like you said, they're down in that trough. That means we're starting to move towards gurus. Like sooner or later, we'll start to come out of that and see where it's really helpful. And I believe that its overall helpfulness when we start to use it correctly is just absurd. Like it will be like nothing that we've had before. So really positive going into next year, actually.
There's a lot of that. I think that's the cool part. That is the, if you go back to the beginning and we talked about the dumpster fire and the peak of Mount Stupid, et cetera, I do think we will claw out of it because I do believe that there is a ton of power and we see it in little areas right now, right? And there's glimpses of it. And I think as that same person that I was talking to about some of the other stuff I want to work through in my head said, that future is much more clear from here now, right? It's not here, but it's clear. Clearer as we go down that road. But I've got to go back because you just said Wheaton's Law. And I think we need to end on this because, you know, we kind of ended on this on the end of the year when we did the Dorks, you know, Gifts for Your Dorks episode. Wheaton's Law is a principle stating that people should be kind and respectful to one another, often summarized as don't be a dick. And I think if the industry, if the world, people, etc. I don't care if you're in politics. I don't care if you're in business. I don't care if you're at your kid's school. If you're in the pickup line, I think we could all learn a little bit from that. Can we realize that? Like, I like it. I mean, John, I think you nailed it, man. So, I agree with your final thoughts on a few of those things. Nathan, any final thoughts on the year?
I think doubling down on the hyperscale. What's exciting about that is that it is pure capitalist driven innovation, right? Like there are very few areas in our industry where like just the ability to build faster and money is no object and there are very limited restrictions in the way because all of our other complaints are around restrictions and all these things why we can't do what we should. So like, man, double down on those hyperscale. Let's see what we can do there, but also recognize that that's not the rest of the industry. So yeah, we have to figure out how to do that for other folks. But my dark horse going into 2026 is the Department of Transportation, these DOTs. Yeah, I think I've been to their IHEAP, this Highway Engineering Conference last couple of years. And there's just been a lot of excitement, at least on the designer side and getting more so into the contractor side. And so while it's so different from vertical construction, a lot of the data-driven theories, the data enablement, all these things we've been talking about from less of a technical constructability, but more of just a operational metrics and performance. Like we can apply a lot of that stuff to DOTs and they can just take it and run with it and then some because they're set up with structure, transparency, governance, other things. So yeah, I think they have an opportunity to really leapfrog a lot of other parts of the industry.
Who was it that we had on from Kiewit that we talked about that exact former Procore, Kiewit originally, Procore again?
Connor Christian.
Connor Christian. Connor, yeah. If you want to look back and tie up with what Nathan just said, go listen to the Connor Christian episode, because they are actually set up in a data world that is very different than ours in a structure. But I have a tendency that we'll keep an eye on that one. Jonathan, I'm going to give you one shot for the final thought.
I'm good. I'm good. I am. I'm good. Like.
Yeah, we're done with 2025.
Yeah, I don't disagree. Like I said, I was like, oh, it looks like it's going to be good. And in the back of my mind is like Nathan's dumpster fire. And I'm like, oh yeah, wait, somebody's going to say, hold my beer. And January is going to be interesting, you know?
Well, here's to it. Thanks guys for joining me. Thanks, Travis. We missed you on the way out the door. Here's to a wonderful 2026 and putting 2025 behind us as this one comes out, because I hope everybody enjoyed their time off and is ready for 2026. So,
well, and last note, Jeff, this is a labor of love. I know you put a lot of time into, so thank you, man, for all the effort you do for this.
Yeah, definitely.
A lot of folks that do come up and say that they listen, and they are out there. So for all you listeners out there, thank you for listening. And Jeff, thank you for all the time you put into this.
And you know what? That never gets old, man. I have to say it happens a lot these days, and I absolutely thoroughly enjoy it that people appreciate what we do. And you're right, it is a labor of love, and it's not all sunshine and roses, but it is worth it because I get to sit down with you guys all the time and geek out. So I appreciate it. And so thanks for that.
Take the excuse anytime.
Thank you for tuning in today to Geek Out for our year in review with the crew. To read all our news stories, learn more about our guests, and to listen to this show, visit thecontentcrew.com. This is The Content Crew signing out. Until next time, enjoy the ride and geek out.